And welcome back to Tuesday's Topical Currents. Thanks so much for joining us. I'm Bonnie Berman, and Joseph Cooper is recovering from his back injury. He's doing much better, I'm happy to say. I thought I would just take a couple of minutes with a little background about today's guest for those of you who may be unfamiliar with the case. In March of 1994, Damien Eccles and two other teenagers were found guilty of the deaths of three 8-year-old children in West Memphis, Arkansas. They became known as the West Memphis Three. The other two, Jason Baldwin and Jesse Miskelly, were sentenced to life in prison. Damien Eccles was sentenced to death by lethal injection. A documentary about the case, Paradise Lost, The Child Murders at Robin Hood Hills, was released in 1996. It cast tremendous doubt on the guilt of the West Memphis Three and sparked international interest in the case. Lori Davis, a successful landscape architect living in New York City, saw an early screening of the film. Shortly after, she wrote her first letter to Damien Eccles at the Tucker Maximum Security Unit in Tucker, Arkansas, where Eccles was imprisoned on death row. Beginning as an exchange of letters between them, their correspondence led to love, marriage, salvation, and ultimately led to the release of the West Memphis Three in 2011. In largest part, it was due to the efforts of Lori Davis and several other people, but mostly Lori. Their collection of mostly love letters over a period of 16 years have been published as Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. And I'm so happy to have Damien Eccles and Lori Davis with us today. They join us from New York City. Welcome, Lori. It's a pleasure to meet you.
Thank you. Thanks so much for having us on.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Welcome back, Damien. How are you both?
Excellent. How are you?
I'm good, thank you. Damien, I don't know if you remember, but you were on this program nearly 2 years ago upon the release of your book, Life After Death. And you made such a profound impact that I had wanted to have you back just to know how your life was going. And then you tweeted about this book, and I follow your tweets, and I was thrilled that we could have you, both you and Lori. So great to have you.
Thank you very much. Thanks so much.
So, Lori, let's begin with you. I'd like if you take us back to that day in 1993 when you went to the Museum of Modern Art. You saw the documentary, an early screening of the documentary Paradise Lost. I know you were a movie buff, but did you have any prior knowledge of the West Memphis Three before you went into that film?
I didn't, other than seeing the synopsis in the program. It was a film series that I was, that it was included in a film series at MoMA. So I read a little bit about the case and actually decided I didn't want to see the film.
How come?
It took a, I wasn't interested in true crime. I thought it sounded very depressing for a rainy Monday night and a 9 o'clock screening in New York. And I thought, it's the last thing I really want to do. But a friend of mine persuaded me to do it, and I just had this niggling feeling for some reason that I should see it.
Okay, so you saw the film. What happened? Can you remember your feelings and thoughts and why your fierce desire to write that first letter to Damien?
I recall being very affected by the film, and I think anyone who sees it feels something like that. There's a sense of tragedy and a great injustice that has incurred. It's a horribly sad film and hard to watch. But being from the South myself, I understood the culture. I understood what Damien was up against. I was raised in a fundamentalist religious home, and I think I saw a bit of myself in him. Mm-hmm. In the way that he handled himself. I'm not going to say I was a big rebel or anything like that growing up, but he was just quietly rebellious in his own way, even on the stand. And I came out of it a couple of days later just thinking, I want to help him if I can, and I want to ask him if he would accept my help. And so I wrote to him.
So when you wrote that first letter, did you have any big expectations?
I didn't, really. I didn't know what to expect. I had no idea. I tried to do some research. The internet at that time was fledgling, and so I couldn't really do a search and find out what had happened since. I went to the library and looked up microfiche and couldn't find that much except for pieces about the case. So I didn't know what had happened since. And so I didn't know what to expect. I didn't know really what had happened since the film, you know, since the film had been done.
Right. Okay, Damien, you'd been on death row for 2 years already, and you'd received many letters in prison, correct?
Right.
So can you remember what you first felt upon receiving Lori's letter? Did it stand out from the others?
Absolutely. You know, whenever the first documentary came out, I started hearing from people at first all over the country and then a little later all over the world. At the height, I believe I was receiving close to 200 letters a day at some points. And even at that young of an age, you know, I was still in my early 20s, but everything that I had been through, it had made me very jaded with humanity. You know, I'd reached a point where I started to think people are all the same. You know, they're pretty much interchangeable. And then whenever Lori came into my life, it completely obliterated that. You know, I knew from the very first letters that there was something completely and absolutely different about her. It was one of those things where she made me want to see the world through her eyes. She made me want to see things the way she did. You know, she would see things that most people wouldn't even think twice about, just normal, daily, mundane occurrences. But she would see them in a way that made them seem magical. And it made me want to be able to see the world the way she did, to even be a little more like her. No one had ever done that before.
It seems like, you know, from the letters, and I read them all, that you fell in love quite early on. So how did that, these letters and this feeling, these feelings that you had for Lori change your existence on death row? What did it mean to you to start getting these and communicating with her?
To be honest, it wasn't always pleasant. You know, the only thing I can compare it to is someone who has had one of their limbs traumatized, you know, an arm or a leg that's been severely damaged, and then they have to go through the rehabilitation process to, you know, train it again, to get it to function properly again. And that's what I sort of had to go through emotionally. You know, I'd been through so much trauma and just, I had been destroyed inside by everything that I had been through. So whenever Lori came into my life, it was like it forced me to start using muscles that I had not used in a long time, that had been severely damaged. And to be honest, it could be pretty unpleasant at times, because then not only was I going through this extreme situation externally, but I also had this extreme situation going on internally, which was falling in love with her.
And so did it make it difficult, the longing and the wanting to be with her, did it make it even more difficult in those ways?
It did in the beginning, but as time went on, something changed. And I think a lot of it was our spiritual practice together, the meditation, the energy work. We slowly grew to look at our lives together as we're together right now. You know, we're not looking down the road to someday in the future when we may live in the same house together. We are together right here, right now. She may be on that side of the wall and I may be on this side of the wall, but it's no different from, you know, when a husband and wife go to work every morning. That doesn't mean they're not together anymore. And that's the way we grew to look at our lives. So there were times, especially, you know, as the years progressed, when I would not even think about the prison for days at a time, because all I would think, all I would see, all I would dwell on was the world that we were creating together, the things we were doing together, the things we were talking about, thinking about, the books we were reading together, things like that. I became so focused on our life that a lot of times the prison sort of faded into the periphery.
That's amazing. One thing I found extraordinary about you, Lori, was your complete and unwavering faith in yourself, your judgment, your instincts. You were so certain right from the outset that you were doing the right thing. How did that fare with your friends and family?
Well, most of them I think that's how I've been most of my life. Not that I haven't made mistakes, but I've always been very determined in anything that I took on. And so it was the same with this. I'm sure they had their misgivings and were worried about me, but no one tried to talk me out of it or told me I was crazy. Or I did wait for 4 years before I told my family, just because I wanted to be more secure and grounded in what I was doing and know where I was as far as in my relationship with Damien, as well as working on his case. So I waited a while to tell them. But yeah, and that's exactly how I felt about it. I did feel very secure in my instincts about him and about what I was doing, even though sometimes I felt like I was free-falling.
Yeah, I mean, of course, given the distance and all the restrictions that you both had to, you know, sustain on a daily basis.
Yes.
Damien, you opened your heart, soul, spirit. You told Lori all your, you know, all about you, but you omitted, for the most part, the daily torture you were experiencing in prison. Why did you do that?
I think it was a couple of reasons. One was because I didn't want to think about it. You know, like I was saying, we were creating this world together where the last thing on my mind was the prison. So I didn't want to bring that into that world. It was our life together was what was keeping me sane. You know, it was almost like a separation. There were two different worlds. And as long as I kept my focus on that, then I didn't have to think about those things. But the other thing was also just trying to spare Lori.
Right.
You know, there's no point or purpose in sitting around complaining about something that no one can fix. Not only that, but also, you know, if she had to know on a daily basis what I was going through, the starvation, the beatings, the torture, and there's nothing she can do about it but sit there and know that it's happening, mm-hmm. then she becomes tortured too. You know, to have to sit there and watch someone you love being tortured and tormented on a daily basis, something like that can drive a person insane.
Mm. We're speaking with Damien Eccles and Lori Davis. They've written Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row on today's Topical Currents. We need to take a quick break and we'll be right back.
Dear Damien, I really wanted to wait until you had a chance to reply to my letter, if you wanted to, before I bombarded you with another, but I have so many thoughts running through my head. I've decided to write them all down. If I am encroaching on your privacy in any way and you don't want me to write, please don't hesitate to let me know. Like I have mentioned already a few times, I don't know why I feel compelled to have contact with you. I just do. So I will write until you tell me to stop.
Dear Lori, believe me, I in no way think that my privacy is being invaded, and I do not mind being bombarded with letters. Thank you for telling everyone about me. Maybe if everyone were to take as big an interest as you have, things could happen a lot faster.
Even with as much as I have loved and love people in my life, I've never allowed anyone to take up residence in my soul. But you just seem to belong there. Being in love with you is the single most beautiful, inspiring, breathtaking, erotic thing I have ever known. It is all-encompassing. I really never knew I could feel this way about anything.
Does it not seem like a miracle to you? We have touched, and it was the most natural thing I have ever felt. That was the touch I was created to feel.
Dearest Damien, there is no doubt in my mind that you are a very strong part of my past. No doubt. All I had to do was see you, hear you speak, and I was gone, literally.
Yeah. And those are, well, from the very early letters to actually the first letter from you, Damien. Oh, the first letter from you, Laurie, and the first letter from you, Damien, and then excerpts from little later letters. We're speaking with Damien Eccles and Laurie Davis. They've compiled their letters with postscripts in them, Yours for Eternity, A Love Story on Death Row. How do you feel when you hear that? Laurie, Damien, either one.
It's hard. It's hard to hear. First of all, it's very intimate, and that's what letters are. But to hear your own voice, and also to just remember doing the audiobook, it was really difficult to go back and read over all of those letters and have all those memories come flooding back, even though we did it in the editing process of the, you'd think that after a while that would wear off, but hearing it just now, it just came all back again. So it's emotional to hear them.
And to be honest, it's also a little unpleasant in a way. You know, I always tell people whenever we do public talks, imagine if one day you came across a journal that you had written 20 years ago and you opened it up and started reading it and had to see the person you were two decades before, you know, having to see how much you had changed, how much you had grown, and looking at it and quite frankly thinking about what a dumbass you are.
I don't think you sounded like that, Damien, or Laurie. No, not at all. Why did you decide to make them public, the letters? I have a lot more to go through with the letters, but what made you decide to do this?
One of the reasons, it was a hard decision for me to make because I've always been a very, very private person. I'm not anymore, but Damien and I do talks across the, actually around the world now, and we always do a Q&A afterward, and it never fails that we get asked about how did you maintain your relationship, and most of the time it's asked by people who are going through difficult things themselves, and it always comes back to communication in any relationship, and I think that there was, after, it's been 3 years since Damien was released, and I feel that if there's anything from our relationship or our experience that can help people, that's of utmost importance to me. And so, I don't know, it just felt like something that might be of help to people. And we've had many people come up on the book tour talking about how, you know, they're going to go home and write a letter to their spouse, or, you know, they'll think differently about their relationship with anyone that they love. So I think that's a part of it. It's complicated. All of it was complicated for me as far as why to do it or not to do it.
Damien?
I think pretty much the same thing. You know, it's also sort of, I guess, the final frontier as far as this case and that period of our lives is concerned. You know, everything else had sort of been documented. You know, if people wanted to know about the case and the trial itself, there have been four documentaries, you know, the three Paradise Lost documentaries and West of Memphis. Mm-hmm. If they wanted to know about my life in general, then there was the first book that I had published, Life After Death. This book went into our relationship, which is something that we had never allowed the world into before. We had always sort of fought fiercely to protect it from other people. You know, it was something sacred to us that we didn't want the world to dissect and be able to just look at and examine. And we finally decided we just wanted to do that. We wanted to go into the final realm of what there was in that time period of our lives so that we can move forward from here on.
To something new. To leave
it
behind.
Yes, it's sort of like a sense of closure in a way.
Well, I'm skipping around now because of what you just said. When you released, I saw West of Memphis, because the last time you were on, you talked about that it was going to be released soon, which it was in January of last year. From that film, were any attempts made to find the real murderer, any attempts to hold public officials accountable, for your wrongful imprisonment, any efforts to obtain your exoneration?
There's, at this point, there's almost nothing that we can do. Really, I believe, you know, I always tell people, I'm positive, I'm certain that one day me and the other two guys who were convicted will be completely exonerated. But, I mean, look how long it took us just to get this far, you know, almost 20 years.
Right.
So I don't think it's going to be something that happens overnight. Honestly, I believe what's going to have to happen, a lot of people have built careers for themselves off of this case. You know, the judge went on to become a senator. The prosecutor went on to become a judge. Mm. The attorney general was running for governor. So these people are not going to just come out and admit that they sentenced an innocent person to death while allowing a child murderer to walk free for 20 years. So really, I believe what it comes down to, we're going to have to wait for these people to either retire or be voted out of office, and new people come into those positions who don't have an interest in protecting, you know, their political careers from past mistakes before things are finally rectified.
And justice is served.
Exactly.
I was struck while reading the letters because it seems you had pretty easy access to one another through the letters. And I was just wondering, don't prisons watch over your outside communications pretty closely? I mean, did they read all these letters?
I think it's probably impossible for them to read all letters just because of how many people you have in prison. But I'm sure a lot of it was read. And that was one of the things we had to deal with psychologically very early on. You know, those letters for a long time were all we had. Before we started talking on the phone, before we started seeing each other in person, all we had was those letters. So you have to sort of wrestle with this decision between how much of yourself you're willing to reveal whenever you know that complete strangers are watching every single word, every single move you make, mm-hmm. every, you know, inch forward that you progress in this courtship. You're constantly being watched like you're in a zoo. You have to wrestle with that versus knowing this is all you have and you have to just throw caution to the wind and put yourself out there because this is all you have.
Let's talk about the first time you actually heard one another's voices. If you would explain those phone limitations and the outrageous expense, but first tell me what it was like when you first spoke.
The phones. There's a phone system in Arkansas. It's also in other states now. I think there have been a few states where people have filed class action lawsuits to try to fix it somewhat, but the prison had a contract with the phone company where the prison gets 51% of every phone call. A 15-minute phone call could cost as much as $25. So it is horrendously expensive for people in prison to call, you know, family members, loved ones on the outside. Most, you know, there aren't any rich people in state prison, so right. Most people couldn't afford it at all. I believe the very first time we talked, I can still remember it, I was, they would bring the phone to my cell and hand it to me through the bars, and I remember sitting on the floor of the door of my cell with my back pressed against the bars, holding the phone, and the first thing I ever said to Lori was, "Are you okay?"
Hmm. Do you remember Lori?
I do, and also remember his very, very thick Delta accent. That's one of the first things I remembered, because his accent was real. It's still strong, but it was a lot stronger then, and I was in Brooklyn, and I kind of had a feeling he was going to be calling around the time, but I didn't know what day, and I didn't know what time. And I was living in Park Slope, and I was fortunate enough to have a garden, and I was sitting out in my garden, and I just remember being so happy to hear his voice and to be able to talk to him. It was very exciting for me, and also to just open up that whole new form of communication with him.
And how long was it? I don't remember. How long was it before you could actually have that first phone call? There was a phone list, and Lori couldn't get on it for a time.
They had all these really odd rules, like you could only put someone's phone number on your approved calling list like twice a year. So we had to wait several months before how many months was
like
it?
Like 5 months, maybe. Mm.
So we were writing to each other for maybe 5 months before we
a lot of letters.
Started talking.
A lot of letters. Well, just to give our listeners an idea, at one point, and it wasn't at the end, but Laura, you said that the phone calls so far had spent had costed $57,000.
Actually, by the time Damien got out, we had probably surpassed that. It had probably gotten to about $120,000. By the time he got out. Phone calls were very expensive, and that's another unfortunate part about this whole story, and something I think most people don't know, but it's very expensive to maintain a relationship with someone in prison. Number one, the phone calls are so expensive. Usually prisons are out in the middle of nowhere and you have to drive long distances to get there. Gas is expensive. And I had the means to do it. I was able to pay for the phone calls and fly down to see him. And once I got to Arkansas, I could drive down to see him every week. But most people, as Damien said, aren't rich who are in that situation. And so a lot of families go without that contact because they just can't afford it.
Mm. You'd think they'd make it a little easier.
Well, it has a lot of ramifications. You know, they've done all these studies that show that recidivism, the rate of recidivism, people returning to prison drastically goes down with the more contact the person has with the outside world. You know, the more contact they have, the more communication they have with their friends, with their family members, the less likely they are to return to prison. Politicians give a lot of lip service to decreasing recidivism rates, but in reality, they're not that keen on it. I mean, the state prisons receive vast amounts of money for every person they keep in prison. It's basically a business, and they want to keep that business going.
Mm. Well, let's move to the time you first saw each other. Albeit it was on either side of the glass partition and the cage or whatever. What did that feel like for each of you when you finally could see each other?
Well, for me, it was overwhelming, I would have to say. I flew down from New York, and I didn't plan it very well. I didn't take into consideration how much... for lack of another way to, it's very overwhelming and stressful to go into a prison, and I'd never been into one before, let alone it was a maximum security prison. Mm-hmm. So I wasn't prepared emotionally or in any way for that, and so I just flew down there the night before and had a very early visit with Damien. It started at 8:00 in the morning. And so I think combined with all the emotional, just what I felt for him emotionally and also just dealing with the stress of the prison and also seeing, I hadn't seen him since I saw him in the film. And the man that I saw weighed about 116 pounds, had hair that was down his back and dark circles under his eyes, and it was very obvious that he had been through torture and starvation and all kinds of things. So it was hard for me to see mm-hmm. him for the first time, although I was just so happy to be in the room with him. and we just immediately started talking and everything else fell away.
And Damien?
I think for me the thing that sticks out the most is just how horrible it is when it ends. You know, whenever you go down there, whenever I would go down there, and the time that I would spend with Lori, it was like being able to fully and completely enter the world that we had created together, where you are surrounded, enveloped in sort of like a pocket of love, of protection. And then when that time is up, you have to step out of it and go back into the starkest, coldest, most brutal environment that you can possibly imagine. Just the most soulless, dark place. So it was like it hurt more and more and more every single time she would have to leave.
How long could you spend together?
We were allowed 3 hours together once a week.
And, yeah, and was that on Fridays?
Usually. We would try to always schedule it on Fridays just to, you know, Lori at this point, most of the time I was in prison, was still trying to work a normal, you know, daily job. So right. She would work extra hours Monday through Thursday just to have Friday off so that she could come to the prison.
So, Lori, you left your job and you moved closer. You moved to Arkansas ultimately, right? And what year was that?
1998.
And then the next year, you got permission to get married in prison.
Oh, yeah, we did. We did.
Yeah. Tell us about that.
Damien was studying Buddhism at the time, and I was also studying it. So we decided to have a Buddhist wedding. So my Dharma teacher agreed to officiate it, and we were allowed to invite six people. We ended up inviting friends. We didn't have family come. And it was a beautiful ceremony. It was about an hour long, and since it was a Buddhist ceremony, there was a lot of freedom in that the prison didn't understand. They were used to just having like a 10-minute ceremony with, you know, a pastor or something. And so because they didn't really understand what a Buddhist ceremony would be, we included lots of, you know, hugs and kisses and bowing, and really extended it. So it was, and it was lovely, even though Damien was, I think, in a bit of shock because it was the first time he had been touched by anyone in about 6 years.
Right. And that was
Let
the
alone
first time.
Getting married.
Yeah, right. You know, one thing I noticed that I found kind of strange at the end of your letters, and you stopped doing a lot of letters, it looked, after 2005. Well, one thing I want to say is that it struck me that, Lori, you spoke of the nearness of Damien's release in those early letters. I mean, did you ever imagine it would be another 13 or 14 years before this would happen?
Oh, no. And not to say that I would have changed my mind, but boy, it sure would have made it a whole lot harder if I would have known how long. I actually expected it. I had it in my mind that it was going to take about 5 years. Mm. And I went to Arkansas thinking, I can certainly give 5 years of my life to do this.
And I honestly don't know that I could have survived if I would have known how long it was going to take. You know, I can remember when I first got to death row, someone who was working on the case told me that I was probably going to be there about 3 years. And I remember thinking, 3 years? Mm. Oh my God, 3 years in prison. I ended up being in there for 18 years and 76 days, all total. You know, if someone would have told me that I was still going to be sitting there almost 20 years later, I don't think I could have taken it.
And how many of those years were in solitary confinement?
Almost the last decade. I was moved to a super maximum security prison where I was in solitary confinement 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From that point on, I never even saw sunlight again until I got out. You know, there are all these things. They, you know, for example, if you contact the prison spokesperson, they'll tell you that death row inmates are allowed out of their cell for an hour a day. Well, what they don't tell you is out of your cell just means in another cell. They take you out of your cell and put you in another cell for an hour, and that's considered your recreation time. You know, it's not like you're outside walking free. That was a lot of what destroyed my eyesight. It was also the hugest, by far, obstacle that I had to overcome whenever I got out. You know, I'd been in solitary confinement for so long that I just had no preparation for dealing with the world again, for human contact again, and it completely devastated me on a lot of levels.
Damien, I don't want to belabor, you know, the details of your incarceration, because I know you don't really want to, but why did they put you in the solitary confinement for all those years? I mean,
a lot of it was money. You know, like I was saying a while ago, prison is an industry. It's a business, a money-making complex. And at one time, the federal government was handing out millions and millions of dollars to states who would just say, you know, it was during after 9/11 and they've got the big security scares, and from then on all you had to do was say, we need more money for security purposes, and they would give you more money at the prisons. So they had, God knows what they had done with the money that they had gotten from the government. Then at one point federal inspectors came in and told them, you know, this isn't what you said you were going to do with this money. We need to see some sort of increased security. That's what you said you needed all this money for. Mm-hmm. So they built a super maximum security unit prison. There's very few of them in the U.S. And they used to brag. They would bring in tours of people, you know, politicians and whatnot, to look around the prison, and they would always bring them on death row. And they would brag about how the guys on death row were the most well-behaved out of the entire prison population. Yet we were the very first ones that they chose to move over into the supermax whenever they had to fill up that space.
I just want to read something that you wrote in an early letter, because this, I want our listeners to know that just this about you, and that you would be, have been, you know, put in solitary confinement for 10 years is just, you wrote that amid all the devastation, you discovered that even in the greatest depths of your despair and misery, I was still in love with the simple fact of my existence. Pretty remarkable words after a few years on death row. How were you able to get to that place of peace?
Once again, I think it wasn't necessarily so much a place of peace as it was a place of excitement, excitement at being alive. And really what it all comes back to is our spiritual practice together. You know, what we did, what we pursue, not only Buddhism, but what we call magic. Magic spelled with a K, M-A-G-I-C-K. And what that means, whenever you see it spelled that way, it's like a amalgamation of Gnostic Christianity and esoteric Judaism and ancient Chinese energy circulation practices, all these things combined. And that's what we would focus on a daily basis. And if something, you know, whenever you really start to practice it, it makes something in you come alive in a way that you haven't been before. It makes you start to see the world in a different way, to experience things in a different way. And there are times, even in prison, whenever, you know, I would wake up in the morning and I would be so excited that I get to start another day and do these practices again. You know, I think for most people, whenever they think of a spiritual practice, they think of a belief, something they believe. You know, it's very intangible. It's about this belief of what happens to you after you die. And that's not what magic is about at all. Magic is about right here, right now, serving a practical function, a purpose. You know, for me, for example, there's very little medical care or dental care in there. You know, they're not going to spend a lot of time and money and energy taking care of someone they plan on killing. Mm-hmm. So there were times when I was in extreme pain, when I was incredibly sick, times I was so sick that I didn't even think I was going to make it through the night. And it was those practices which helped me deal with the pain, helped me deal with the sickness, and helped me deal with the trauma. And it just made me excited to realize, you know, what it's possible to do with nothing, just doing these practices. And it would make me just excited thinking about the future, what else I was going to discover next, you know, what, how else I was going to find that this would help me. And it just, that's what made me excited about existence.
Yeah, and I want to add to that, because when we're talking about, you know, I spent 16 years waiting for Damien to get out and working toward his release, and Damien, of course, spent over 18 years. One of the things that helped me, and I know helped him too, is once you decide that this is your goal and this is what you want, and, you know, people can call it prayer, they can call it magic, they can call it whatever they want, but it's the anticipation of that thing. And every day we would wake up anticipating something big happening. And so that it shows in our letters, you know, we talk about his release all the time.
Right.
But, and there were big things that would happen, huge things that would come about. And of course, the big one for this situation was their release in 2011. But there were times along the way when, you know, we would have huge victories, or people would come into our lives that would change everything. And so, and we still live like that to this day. waking up every morning and just expecting amazing things to happen.
One of the metaphors we use is of a race car driver. You know, when they're teaching a race car driver to drive, they tell him, don't look at the wall. You know, you look at your instrument panel, you look at the other cars on the track, you look at the track itself, but you don't focus on the wall. Because if you do, sooner or later you're going to drive into it. Your life is going to move in the direction that you focus your attention and your energy. So we practiced every single day, and it's not easy. It's hard. It's like a wrestling match every day. But every day we kept our focus on the image of what we wanted, which was a life with me out of prison and us living together happily. We'd never looked at the wall, which in our case would have meant, you know, me being executed or spending the rest of my life in prison and us never getting a chance to be together. Right. Anytime those fears, anytime those images come into your mind, we had to train ourselves to pull our focus right back to moving towards that finish line that we wanted.
I want to talk more about your lives today after we take a short break on Topical Currents, speaking with Damien Eccles and Laurie Davis. They've written Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. Welcome back to today's Topical Currents. Bonnie Berman visiting with Damien Eccles and Laurie Davis, who've written Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. So what is your relationship like today? I know that you had some rough times there when Damien was first released, but when you awaken in the morning with Laurie by your side and Damien by your side, what's it like for you? What are your first thoughts? What are your first feelings?
Happiness. It's really great to have him with me. And I mean, I think upon his release, it was difficult for both of us, mostly him, who was struggling. He struggled a great deal with PTSD. And as you know, I don't think I certainly wasn't equipped or ready to handle that or even understand what he was going through. But, you know, we've worked through a lot, and he certainly worked a lot on his own to heal himself, and still is. He's got a ways to go, but he's done amazing things as far as securing his independence and trying to heal from all of those wounds. But I don't know, we wake up in the morning and he has a coffee and I have a tea, and we're just really happy to be together all the time, actually. It's really pretty great.
Which is what you foresaw. Go ahead, Damien.
Those are the good times, the easy times, you know, waking up in the morning, and it's almost like being in a nest, you know, just having coffee and sitting out on the balcony, the terrace, and feeling the air, things like that. But it also, you know, earlier in the show you were talking about how I had been on the show before whenever Life After Death came out, and you know, I can remember almost nothing of that first year that I was out, just because I was in such a deep state of shock and trauma that it was like it was everything I could do to keep putting one foot in front of the other just to get through the days. I was scared of everything. I lived in a constant state of terror. You know, a lot of times whenever we're doing public talks, what we compare it to is, imagine when you're driving in the winter and you hit a patch of ice on the road and your car starts skidding out of control towards the guardrail, and you know with absolute certainty you're about to hit that guardrail, and you have that huge surge of adrenaline that just burns you out inside. And then at the last moment your tires catch and you're fine and you drive down the road, but you're still left with that huge surge of adrenaline. That would happen to me 10, 15, 20 times a day whenever I first got out. You know, it got to the point where I would drink 10, 12 cups of coffee a day, and it had no effect on me whatsoever. And I thought, oh, it must be a good thing. That must mean I'm in really good shape or something. And then I finally went to the doctor for a checkup, and he said, no, what that means is you have lived in such a fight-or-flight state for so long that you have completely burned out your adrenal system. So most people, whenever they drink caffeine, get a tiny adrenaline surge. You're not getting anything because you burned your whole system out. I was in fear all the time, and It took me at least a year to even start coming out of that.
Do you feel free now?
Not completely, no. You know, I talked to a guy one time. We were doing something with the Innocence Project, and there were a lot of other guys that had been on death row there. One guy had been on death row for about 16 years, and he had been out for a while, and I asked him, I said, how long did it take before you felt normal again? And he said, about 5 years. Mm-hmm. He said, you don't get used to being in prison in a single day, and you don't get used to being out of prison in a single day. I think for me it'll go faster. I can tell a huge, huge difference just in the past 6 months, because what I've always done to cope with things like that is I know I have to throw myself wholeheartedly into whatever it is that scares me, into whatever I fear. I have to throw myself into it so that it loses its power over me. And that's sort of what I started doing once I was out of shock and could do that. You know, I started forcing myself to do things like going into the subway system with not even a particular destination in mind and just riding somewhere and getting off and then trying to find my way back home. It's been really, really traumatic, and it's, you know, the way I go about things is not something I would recommend to everyone. I think everyone has their own ways of dealing with trauma. Mm-hmm. I would say I'm probably 65-70% back to normal.
That's pretty good. Something you just mentioned about the Innocence Project, and we don't have too much longer, so I want to also get back to your relationship. But are you involved? Are you involved with trying to obtain release of anyone with whom you were imprisoned, or anyone else for that matter?
One of the people, the guys on death row right now that we believe is innocent, is a man named Tim Howard. And his case is one that's been drug out for a very long time. He's right there in Arkansas. He was actually in the cell next to me for many years. The other case we're working on, a friend of ours that we want to help, Amanda Knox. You know, we've come to know her. She's become a very good friend of ours, and we want to do anything we can to help her clear her name also.
What are your greatest joys? Is it just the simple things, individually and as a couple? I'm assuming, Damon, you're still not allowed to go to Lori's movies.
Yeah, that's right.
No, I'm not allowed to see her movies, although she does come to my, you know, right. My sort of my philosophy when it comes to movies has always been I don't want to see anything that doesn't have a monster in it. But we are getting more and more to the point where we do see things together now that inspire us, that speak to us, that make us want to do things. One of them, there's a movie out right now called Lucy. I've actually already been to see it 3 times since it came out last week, and we're going to see it again today.
Oh.
Just because it's one of those movies that we both see and it means something to both of us. It's just inspiring. It makes you want to achieve more, do more, not waste your life. So there are things we can agree on, but she still goes and sees a lot of movies by herself and I go and see mine by myself.
Well, thank God she does go see movies by herself, or she wouldn't have seen Paradise Lost.
Yes.
That's right. I think another thing too is we both are finally getting back to being healthy and eating right and taking better care of ourselves, and there's a great deal of joy in seeing the results of taking care of yourself. Mm-hmm. And feeling better now that we've come out of all the shock and trauma, or starting to come out of it, but just feeling better and being happy, and I don't know, it's a good life.
And plans for the immediate future?
We're both working on creative projects, mm-hmm. Writing mostly.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes. I want to write a book about New York. You know, this was the first place we came when I was released from prison, and I immediately just fell head over heels in love with it. I think it's the most magical place on the face of the earth. You know, you're constantly wandering into pockets of strangeness and beauty and horror. And I want to be able to write about all of those things so that even someone who has never been here and may never come here can pick it up and read it and fall in love with this place the way that I have.
Mm. Well, lots more questions, and we'll have to wait for the next time when you write your next book. Damien Eccles and Laurie Davis, Yours for Eternity, a love story on death row. It's been a pleasure having you with us today, and I hope to stay in touch and wish you the very, very best.
Thank you,
Bonnie. It's been great talking to you today.
Yes, thank you for having us again.
Thank you. And thank you for spending your time with us. Our producers, Richard Ives, technical direction from our online producer, Paul Leary. Free audio archives and links at our website, WLRN.org, and our Facebook page. And tomorrow's Topical Currents looks at the dangers and risks associated with sun exposure. Bonnie Berman, hoping your day is a very good one. Please stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.